Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests in two segments today, not even a flirtation with heterodoxy by shoehorning two guests into a single segment. Owen Higgins will talk about the new media landscape where pundits like Glenn Greenwald and Matt Taibbi are featured in outlets funded by tech oligarchs. And then Ronnie Grinberg will look at a classic moment in modern American intellectual history. The mostly Jewish, mostly guys around Partisan Review and the like who started left and ended up mostly on the right. If you spent a lot of time immersed in online punditry, you may have wondered what happened to two stars of that world, Glenn Greenwald and Matt Taibbi. Once more or less on the left, though perhaps they would dispute that, they now lean pretty far to the right, though perhaps they would dispute that too. Greenwald was a sharp critic of the Bush-era Republican Party. Now he carries water for Donald Trump. Taibbi once wrote scathing critiques of Goldman Sachs or Rolling Stone. Now he carries water for Elon Musk. Both now are featured on media outlets like Substack and Rumble, which are financed by right-wing tech moguls like Mark Andreessen, Peter Thiel, and Elon Musk. At this point, one doesn't need to say too much about Musk by way of introduction. The other two are less well-known. Both are venture capitalists and investors, one of my favorite occupational categories. Andreessen got rich and famous 30 years ago as one of the founders of Netscape, and Thiel, along with Musk, was one of the founders of PayPal. He's also been a long-standing patron of right-wing politics and politicians, most notably J.D. Vance. Owen Higgins, his first name is spelled E-O-I-N, is just out with a book on these consequential unions, Owned, How Tech Billionaires on the Right Bought the Loudest Voices on the Left, from Bold Type Books. It's a look at how tech moguls are creating a journalistic landscape that's more about heat than light and personalities rather than institutions. Owen Higgins. Before we get to the dubious stars of the show, Greenwald and Taibbi, I do want to call attention to the centrality of the thuggish billionaires who are close to the re-inaugurated Emperor Trump. Peter Thiel, who also had a lot to do with J.D. Vance's rise, as well Mark Andreessen and the Nazi saluter Elon Musk. What does it mean that this unholy trinity is now so close to state power?
Well, I don't think it means anything good. If you kind of look at their evolution and the way that they have maybe manipulated and controlled communication and discourse over the past 3-4 years, this has been an investment that has paid off for them. They wanted a more conservative, much more importantly, I think, more tech-friendly administration in power, and now they have it. With each one of them, there's something different. So Andreessen has, for a long time, been a real proponent of crypto. He has a lot of his capital in there. He wants to make sure that that pays off. So it seems like he's going to get what he wants. Trump is making noises about some sort of more crypto-friendly administration. One of Andreessen's big complaints about Biden was that he was crypto-unfriendly, and Lena Khan's attacks on the industry, or what he saw as attacks on the industry. So for Andreessen, I think that's kind of what we'll probably see. You know, there's some culture war stuff here, but I think that ultimately he just believes in the money part. Thiel probably sees Trump as part of a long-standing ideological mission that Thiel has had. Thiel is maybe equally invested in, you know, his material wealth and also the ideology, maybe more than the others are, where he's kind of maybe a little more 50-50. He's been pushing for this far-right politics for a long time. Decades. But he did this interview with The Atlantic's Barton Gellman, I think this was back at the end of 2023, where he said he was done. He didn't want to invest any more money or time into politics. He was disappointed in Trump. He didn't like Biden. And he was quiet for most of 2024, and then he started to pop up again on podcasts and doing talks around like the summer. And I think that one of the reasons that he started to do that is he realized that Trump was ascendant, or at least that the right-wing project that Trump was a part of was ascendant. And he made a calculation, a bet, I think, that this was going to be successful. It paid off. That he has such closeness as well to Mark Zuckerberg is also very, very important, with Zuckerberg cozying up to Trump. And then finally, Musk. I mean, there's just a lot to say here.
None of it very good.
Yeah, none of it good. Yeah, I mean, He invested in Twitter, I think, in order to have something like this happen, you know, not necessarily maybe the presidency, but to shape domestic and global opinion. It's hard to argue that it didn't pay off. He may be losing a lot of money on Twitter. Twitter may be a borderline unusable website, but to do what it's doing and to shape the conversation, to make himself like an indispensable, important person who everyone has to listen to is probably equally important. This is a guy, if you just watch his body language and the way that he acts, is desperate for approval and massively insecure. And at the same time, has a huge ego because he's one of the richest people. No, he is the richest person in the world on paper and is now basically living in the White House. So effectively what's going to happen is that now the Department of Government Efficiency, this is what I predict will happen, is going to just funnel money to these big tech companies. And that just is probably works out for Musk quite well. It's hard to argue that it hasn't paid off for all three of those guys. They're probably pretty happy with the way things are going right now.
The politics of these guys is often characterized as libertarian, but the whole industry has been close to the Pentagon forever. And Thiel in particular has made immense amounts of money from the CIA. So that really is the wrong descriptor for these characters.
They would probably describe themselves as libertarians or former libertarians, but you're completely right. All three of these guys, and Bezos as well, I'll talk about Bezos in a second, but all three of these guys have made a lot of money investing in companies that do surveillance, in Thiel's case, Palantir, Starlink and SpaceX and Tesla, in Musk's case, Musk's made billions and billions of dollars from government contracts. And this has been a bipartisan spigot of cash. It hasn't changed really administration to administration.
If we go back to the Clinton years, Silicon Valley leaned Democratic. They were charmed by Gingrich, but they were very close to the Obama administration. What happened to move so much, or especially the big names in that world, to the right?
As I recount in the book, and I'm drifting off of some other historical work that's been done before me, notably Margaret O'Meara's The Code, I think, really goes into this. Malcolm Harris's Palo Alto also delves into this. In the 80s and early 90s, through the first Bush administration, they were still kind of libertarian, kind of right-wing, in the way that a lot of business people would be. In 92, a lot of them switched over to Clinton because I think they could kind of see that Clinton was going to be more malleable. And they also could see that with Perot in the election, that there was a good chance that Clinton could squeak it out. And then, of course, he wins and he gives the dot-com boom and tech is just printing money at this point. They're getting almost everything that they want from Clinton. They're all Democrats, basically, which means that then in 2000, when there's a shift to Bush, a lot of Silicon Valley, maybe not a majority, but a good amount of them move over to the Republican Party. They're supporting Bush. They're supporting that. And then after 9/11, the surveillance and all the tech cash comes, you start to see a little bit of more like, I guess, squishiness. The titans of industry here, the leaders, they're just doing what they have to do to make money. They don't really have an ideological perspective here that's really damaged by going Republican or Democrat. They're able to go back and forth. Once Obama comes in, they all kind of shift to him because he's going to be the winner. You can tell that he's going to win, and he pays them back for how much money that they have invested in his campaign. So during the Obama administration, you know, Google, Alphabet makes just hand over fist. They're in the White House. Elon Musk begins to make his ascent into the public eye and to have his companies making money and getting government contracts. Amazon, through Amazon Web Services, starts to make billions and billions and billions of dollars. Thiel continues to make billions of dollars through his existing contracts with the national security state. Andreessen's multiple investments in different companies also pay off. This is another boom time for Silicon Valley. It really has never really stopped for them. By the time that you get to where we're at now, I mean, these are like some of the most rich, powerful people in the world, arguably the most rich and powerful people and most powerful industry, I think, in the world. And it is an industry that has gone to the right because I think at this point it's kind of more that they don't like the way that Democrats and liberals talk about them, much more, I think, than it is like any fear of having the cash flow shut off.
Of course, and then it's personal, too, for somebody like Musk, his daughter becoming trans certainly affected his politics.
Right. There is a lot of reactionary politics there for him. You see this with Andreessen, too. Andreessen gets called out for these pretty racist comments about India back in 2014. He goes dark on Twitter for a little while. He comes back. He's just a complete reactionary. He's been going to the right ever since. Thiel was already there. Bezos, I don't think, really has much of a politics, but David Sacks was also already there. He's an old friend of Thiel's from back in college, and they share a lot of similar ideologies. So.
On to our stars here. Glenn Greenwald was once close to the MSNBC crowd, notably Rachel Maddow, and very critical of Fox. That's all changed over the last 15 years or so. But your review of this history reminds us that Maddow has changed, too. She was once critical of Democrats, and now she's nothing but a cheerleader. What about that? It just seems like there's been this polarization led by MSNBC and Fox, and they become the North Stars for these two ideological tendencies.
You know, one interesting thing that Glenn said to me, so I interviewed Glenn for this book. Matt declined. Glenn spoke to me for a couple hours. During that, he basically said that he felt that he hadn't changed so much, but that Maddow had changed. He is kind of right about that. If you look at Maddow in the Bush years, especially as there was this kind of fight for control over the future of the Democratic Party, especially between 2006 and 2008, Maddow was certainly on the left side of that and presented herself as something of an outsider insider. If you fast forward to today, she is a hyper-partisan Democrat. Glenn would probably argue that this happened before Trump. I think that's accurate to a point. After Trump, she went much further into the kind of the partisan brain. She has certainly become a big cheerleader for the national security state in ways that she did not used to be. She has been much more supportive of the Democratic Party in general. And I think that her affiliation with the national security state, her feelings about that have changed in direct relation to how close to that part of the government the Democrats have been. You know, after Trump was first elected in 2016, one of the big things coming from the Democratic Party, the long side Russiagate, was to basically say, like, we are the ones who are holding the torch for the national security state, and we are going to be the ones who are in favor of fighting back against Russia and all of the bad guys. And it's like this Cold War conspiracy, fantasy, James Bond-esque vision of the world. Russiagate kind of broke a lot of brains, and I think it did kind of on both sides, because what Matt and Glenn did on the other side was to basically go in equal amount in the other direction. I think you can kind of see that, just to get to your point about MSNBC and Fox, you can see that in Matt's book, Hate Incorporated, which I believe came out in 2019. In the book, he basically argues that Maddow is as or more damaging as Tucker Carlson is, because MSNBC and Fox, in his view, are equally bad, equally partisan, and doing basically the same thing to their audiences. I'm not sure I completely agree with that, but he does have a point about both of these networks driving this partisan divide and driving their audiences apart and kind of pushing this division, because what it really is it's a commercial decision. You know, the more hyper-partisan, the more you can get people to feel angry, the more that they're going to continue to click, read, watch, etc.
I'm speaking with Owen Higgins, author of Owned, How Tech Billionaires on the Right Bought the Loudest Voices on the Left, from Bold Type Books. Okay, so let's talk about Greenwald. What drove him to the right after having been seen as a civil libertarian and an enemy of the Republican Party under Bush and all that? What do you credit this to?
I try to give everybody as much grace and good faith as I can. And I think that to do that with Glenn would basically be to say that he was a strong and staunch critic of the war on terror and the Bush administration for the years that he was writing about it while Bush was in office, and that he had allies like Maddow, like other people in the liberal blogosphere who felt the same way. And that then when Obama came into office, liberals and Democrats decided that these things were good. And so that was very frustrating. And so at this point, right, like I'm totally with him on that. But what I think happened with Glenn is that then he went overboard with basically feeling like liberals are the problem, liberals are the enemy, and so therefore that's going to be my all-consuming politics. By the time that Trump comes in 2016, Glenn's not a supporter of Trump, but he's already kind of primed at this point to feel like, I'm angry at the way that Democrats and liberals are treating any kind of anti-establishment politics, any kind of politics that challenges the national security state. So when the reaction to Trump from liberals and Democrats, et cetera, is to double, triple down on this pro-state secrets, pro-national security framework, his politics during the first Trump administration become essentially to fight back against that tendency. And he will argue, and he has argued, that the reason that he does this is because everybody else in the media is anti-Trump, and so what's the point? And again, like, I don't think that there's anything necessarily wrong with that on its face, but I think that the problem is that then you end up going further and further to the right because that becomes your audience, and that's what happened to him. You start to see this with his culture war views. He starts to endorse these vicious transphobes like Chaya Raichek, the Libs of TikTok woman, and he begins to just kind of excuse any kind of Republican misbehavior. He went so overboard with that that then he just basically became as partisan as what he was criticizing, just in the other direction.
Taibbi, of course, first came to my attention when he was in Moscow with Mark Ames during the exile. I had a late-night interview with them, which they were both flying on multiple drugs, I think.
I bet, yeah.
They were the bad boys. Some of the things those guys did at the exile were easily characterized as misogynist, and both of them were attacked during the Me Too era. You know, the behavior wasn't always admirable, but also the story was amplified by the right, who wanted to go after these guys. Nonetheless, that Me Too attack really contributed to Taibbi's turn to the right. So how do you read his transformation?
That had a lot to do with it, the Me Too movement. You can track this to the end, like the latter months of 2016. So at this point, the Democrats, their kind of liberal media mouthpieces, are all in on Russiagate. This is the way to explain what happened with Trump. There's no reason to do any kind of introspection here. Nope, it has to be Russia. This was very frustrating to watch for, I think, a lot of people. I say all that to say I'm very sympathetic to this frustration. What happened with Matt is that he went all in on that. The result was that this liberal audience that he had built up through his work on the financial crisis and after, and his general punching pretty hard at Republicans and not really so much at Democrats. He was definitely making certain decisions as far as who he was targeting, who he wasn't. Glenn was as well at the time, maybe a little bit less, but he had the history of doing the same thing. Matt's audience kind of started to drift away from him, and a lot of liberals and Democrats got very angry with him for his reporting on Russia, not all of which I think really stands up to the test of time, but some does. What happened here is he wanted to do a reboot with this audience. So he wrote this book about Eric Garner, and he was about to go on a book tour about it. And then the Me Too movement hit, and these writings that he had done at the exile that had been floating around for a long time, but this attack had never really hit, finally did hit. And it hit because of some right-wing agitators like Mike Cernovich pushing it because they hated Taibbi, but also because I think there was like an article in the Washington Post, and, you know, he was getting asked about it at book tour stuff, and the book tour had to get canceled, and the book didn't sell very well. This is at the end of 2017, and really, if you look at Taibbi's behavior and evolution, political evolution since then, you can kind of trace it back to that. And since then, he has just gone further and further to the right. He's, I think, at this point, fully an anti-vaxxer. October 6th, right before the attacks on October 7th, he appeared on Gutfeld, which is a pretty unfunny Fox News comedy hour, where he kind of sat and was laughing about the host's jokes. And then after the attack, he kind of took the Barry Weiss free press line. College professors shouldn't be telling their students that Israel or, you know, is doing anything wrong, and they should just kind of stick to educating people. Before that, he's on like the Daily Wire. He goes all in kind of on this transphobia stuff even more than Glenn does. He's doing stuff with Prager University. He recently wrote something with The Blaze, which is Glenn Beck's publication. I mean, at this point, I think Taibbi is unmistakably just a culture warrior on the right. He can still kind of float on, you know, I used to be a liberal Democrat, or I used to vote for Democrats and all of that. You know, I used to be a liberal, and now, you know, the excesses of liberalism and the left have pushed me to the right. But I don't think he's really going to be able to do that for much longer.
Now, to tie the two parts of this conversation together, Greenwald and Taibbi have been able to waltz into a media ecosystem that has been funded by the unholy trinity, the likes of them, these Silicon Valley right-wingers. Talk about these new media outlets that have been providing a platform for the likes of Greenwald and Taibbi.
And I like the way you said, like, tie it together. So when you're trying, in a book like this, trying to track this political evolution and the things that they talk about and the stuff that they write about to any kind of like financial motivator, it's often hard to find like somebody like giving them just, you know, a stack of cash and being like, here, please write this. But there have been investments in a lot of alternative media outlets and platforms by the same people who we were talking about earlier, right? So Mark Andreessen invests in Substack. After that, Substack starts investing in writers. Some of the writers that they start investing in are pretty far to the right. They start boosting that kind of stuff. Substack's right-wing tilt, which they deny, and I should definitely say that they do deny this, but their right-wing tilt has been noticed by a lot of people, including writers. I am, I guess, still part of a collective called the Discontents, which were a group of Substack writers who were kind of opposed to this. Substack did not give money to Taibbi and Greenwald, but they did make their money on that platform, and I would argue that there were incentives there to promote a certain politics and a certain way. There's something called Substack brain, where you're always trying to get a reaction from people. You're kind of pushing things to the right a little bit. You're being contrarian. So you start to see that kind of stuff. With Greenwald, the real payoff comes when J.D. Vance and Peter Thiel, Vice President J.D. Vance,
yes.
Which is, yeah, that's something.
And Thiel is his mentor.
And Thiel is his mentor, yeah. So, and they both invest in Rumble, which is this Canadian-based right-wing YouTube alternative. And Rumble gives a large contract to Glenn in order to move System Update, which is his podcast slash video show, over to Rumble exclusively. They also paid fellow right-wing pundit and soon-to-be DNI Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard. Glenn also had to move over his writing from Substack over to Locals, which is a blogging platform founded by a guy named Dave Rubin. If you know who he is, then you're as unfortunate as I am, but marginal right-wing figure. But, you know, they moved that over. They also purchased Call-In, which was a David Sacks-founded audio platform, which I recorded podcasts for a year for some money from them. So I'm certainly not blameless here. Like, I've also taken this money.
You can't fault somebody because, you know, there's just so little money in journalism these days unless you're servicing these characters.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, I was offered the money and there was no guidance provided or anything, but it was kind of obvious. Glenn's, you know, just taking the money from this and is just exclusively putting his stuff there. He would argue that Peter Thiel has nothing to do with Rumble. It's kind of hard to make that argument when, you know, Thiel and Vance invest all of this money into Rumble and then Rumble gives money to Glenn. Taibbi is selected because of influence from Andreessen and Sachs by Musk to expose the Twitter files, the reporting of which is not particularly strong, but it certainly gets an ideological point of view out there. And more importantly, I think for Taibbi, probably doubled and maybe more his income from Substack just over the course of that brief reporting. The financial incentives for helping these guys are pretty clear. If you help them, you'll have money. That's kind of how it all wraps together. They're investing in an alternative media superstructure in large part because they want something they can control, where it's not as critical and where it serves their purposes. And there are figures of prominence in the alternative media sphere, people whose independence is part of their brand, like Taibbi and Greenwald, who are then happy to help with that mission and to take the funding.
The value of these guys depends upon their status as former renegades, you know, former anti-establishment people. And now, of course, they're serving the interests of the richest and most powerful tech guys in the world. How long can you pull this off? I mean, how long is your past credibility something that you can trade on?
You know, that's a really good question, and part of me wonders if that credibility is kind of already shot. Is anyone really going to take Matt Taibbi seriously if he goes on Fox and says, as a former Democrat at this point, right? Is anyone going to take Glenn seriously if he says, you know, I used to be opposed to Republicans? Like, at this, if you've been paying any attention at all, you kind of know that these guys are right-wing pundits. At the same time, even for someone who has been as critical of these guys as I am, it is hard for me to completely step away from the knowledge that Glenn's work with the Snowden leaks is still historic. Similarly, Taibbi has some credibility with people who were going to college at the same time that I was, you know, in the middle, late 2000s, who probably still have a bit of a soft spot for him, even if you kind of realize he's gone off the deep end. I think that you see that as far as Taibbi goes with the way that he reported out the Twitter files, very obvious that he thought that this was his Snowden moment. even though it wasn't, but he was still treating it the way that it was. And I saw a lot of people reacting to it, not people on the right, not like Republicans, not people who were kind of primed for this stuff, but kind of people, more independently minded people, maybe who don't pay as much attention to politics and stuff as I do. But we're kind of like, oh, you know, well, maybe there's something to this. And I think that there is a little bit of that credibility still because they have their names. Like, not everybody is paying as much attention to these guys as I am, or even as, you know, most politically clued in people are. It's interesting that neither one of them are really being invited on Fox anymore, but I don't know how much of that is a function of Fox not wanting them on there / them not having enough influence for that. And how much of that is just the fact that media landscape has changed so much where maybe it's no longer as important for them to be on there because they have their own little siloed audience and that's who they're talking to. And if they can occasionally get someone on the outside to come in and kind of check their stuff out, like that's great. You know, like that's a new audience member. But overall, I think that there is a feeling that they are just talking to who they're talking to and they'll take other people as they come.
I was Owen Higgins, author of Owned, How Tech Billionaires in the Right Bought the Loudest Voices in the Left from Bold Type Books. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after musical break.
You say that you want to go to a land that's far away. How are we supposed to get there with the way that we're living today? You talk lots about God. Freedom comes from the car, but that's not what this bitch wants. Not what I want at all. I want
That was some of Lana Del Rey doing Money, Power, Glory. Now we'll look back at a very different journalistic and literary universe, that of the New York intellectuals, the mostly Jewish and mostly male crew, around partisan review, commentary, and the like. Once firmly rooted in the left, after World War II they took a rightward turn, often with some financial help from the CIA. Ronnie Grinberg is an associate professor of history and faculty member in the Schusterman Center for Judaic and Israel Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Her book about that set, Right Like a Man, Jewish Masculinity and the New York Intellectuals, was published last year by Princeton University Press. Ronnie Grinberg. Let's do a little historical background to this cult of masculinity. This Jewish one came after a WASPy one a couple of decades earlier, late 19th, early 20th centuries, Teddy Roosevelt and all that, the cult of manliness, which you wrote some about. What drove these testosterone cultures and their similarities and differences between the two?
Oh, that's a good question. I definitely think with the earlier cult of masculinity or whatever you want to call it, crisis in masculinity, which is a trope that reappears in American life, I think, throughout the 20th century and into our...
We're still in it, right?
We're still in it. We're in another moment of crisis. But I think, you know, Teddy Roosevelt is responding and that moment of a WASP masculinity is responding to the influx of immigrants who are coming over between the 1880s and kind of when immigration restriction is passed in the 1920s. That's an era when many Jews from Eastern Europe are coming over in large numbers. There's also Catholics from Italy and Southern Europe. And there's this fear that white Anglo-Protestant masculinity is under siege. You know, it sort of echoes kind of the great replacement theories that we hear today, right? This idea that immigrants are going to sort of pollute true American identity and masculine identity. And so I think it's a response to that. This is also a period where African Americans start coming up in large number from the South to the urban North. And so there's this sense of an America in flux. It's an era of mass industrialization, kind of a, you know, America's fully transforming from kind of an agrarian. This occurs throughout the 19th century, but there's anxieties about industrialization that are kind of peaking also in this period. And then the second question was what brings about this kind of Jewish masculine cult? it's not a conscious thing, but I think that Jews are seen as outsiders in the early 20th century. They're seen as polluters of white Protestant masculine identity, just like other racial minorities and ethnic minorities are. And so I argue in the book that these sons of immigrants who become the New York intellectuals are influenced by American norms of masculinity in the early 20th century, but there's this sense that Jews don't belong or can't belong. And so they develop their own American Jewish masculinity that draws from traditional Jewish notions of Talmudic masculinity, of a scholarly masculinity, but combines it with American notions of physical aggression and toughness and combativeness to create something new.
Now on to their main cast of characters. Most of them came out of fairly poor backgrounds, and their fathers rarely functioned as breadwinners, made them emasculated by conventional American standards. So what did this do to their consciousness?
When I was reading all the memoir literature, I was struck with how all of them wrote about their fathers as emasculated, sort of in two ways. In one sense, they were emasculated because many of them worked in industry and were not particularly learned. And so in that sense, for these inspiring intellectuals, their fathers weren't quite scholarly enough. But then they come of age during the Great Depression. And so many of their fathers struggled to earn a living. And of course, this is not just a Jewish story. Throughout the 1930s, there's a sense that men are struggling, that there's the forgotten man that needs to be rescued to some extent by New Deal programs to resuscitate masculinity. And so for these burgeoning Jewish intellectuals, they see their fathers as emasculated in two ways. On the one hand, they're not particularly learned. And on the other hand, they're not good breadwinners. They can't support their families. And they see their mothers, Alfred Kazin writes at length about his mother nagging his father, who was a painter, to go out and find more work. And so there's this sense that mothers are domineering as well, emasculating their husbands.
You write later about how Irving Howe had an issue with the stereotypical or archetypical Jewish mother. What was his issue?
Not just Irving Howe, but also William Phillips, who's one of the founding editors of Partisan Review, sort of have this sense that their mothers were overbearing. Irving Howe in World of Our Fathers, his celebrated book on immigrant life, talks about the overpowering, overbearing Jewish mother who not only emasculated their husbands, but infantilized their sons, were afraid for them to, participate in sports because they would get hurt outside. And so there was this sense that Jewish women were stymieing Jewish men to some extent.
Many of the neighbors of our heroes growing up pursued manliness with gangs and sports, but to these guys, being cerebral and argumentative was the way of being masculine. What exactly was their ideal of masculinity?
I write about how this scholarly ideal, this combative intellectual, was not the only model of Jewish masculinity available in these years. And you're exactly right. There's Jews and non-Jews who are kind of engaging and learning about masculinity in street gangs in Brooklyn and in the Bronx in these years, who are taking part in sports. These Jewish intellectuals were definitely fans of sports like baseball, but they didn't participate themselves. And so they begin to aspire to American notions of muscularity, but a muscularity that's cerebral. So they combine American and Jewish notions to create this kind of combative intellectual that I think becomes really influential in the 20th century.
City College was, to mix my metaphors, the Vatican of this culture to a large degree. Why was City College so important?
City College becomes really important because these Eastern European Jews want their sons to be educated. This draws on Jewish tradition, but also ideas of the American dream. And City College is free. And so in the early 20th century, it is really the home of immigrants. And we don't have exact numbers, but probably from the early 19-teens into World War II, City College is somewhere between 85 and 95% Jewish. And this is also an era when quotas are being adopted by private universities, particularly private elite universities, including Harvard and Princeton and Columbia, because there's a sense that Jews are becoming too prevalent. They excel scholastically, and so they're being admitted into these schools.
there's a sense, getting back to this sort of crisis of masculinity and also this xenophobic nativist moment in American life, that if we don't establish some way to limit Jewish enrollment, then these schools are going to be overtaken by Jews. This is the beginning of our kind of modern admission system that takes into account things like character, things besides just intellectual merit. That system was initially devised as a way to root out Jews who were scoring really well on admission tests and getting really good grades. And so these schools are no longer admitting nearly as many Jews, but also Eastern European Jewish immigrants wouldn't have the money to attend many of these schools anyway, and City College is free. So it becomes this proletarian Jewish Harvard in the first half of the 20th century.
So what kind of institutions did these City College generation enter? What are some of the outlets where they express themselves?
In the 1930s, when they graduate, there aren't that many jobs. So they gravitate towards little magazines that begin to form in the years before World War II and that explode in the post-war period. And so the most well-known is Partisan Review.
What year was that founded?
It's founded initially in 1934 under the auspices of the John Reed Club, which is a communist writers group. But its editors, William Phillips and Philip Rov, once they're sort of disenchanted with communism, they close the magazine and they relaunch it in 1937, free from the John Reed Club, as anti-Stalinist. 1937 is the beginning of the modern Partisan Review that many people know of today. And there was another journal called the Menorah Journal, which is actually founded earlier in the 20th century, and it's edited by someone named Henry Hurwitz, who had gone to Harvard and founded something called the Menorah Society as a place where Jews could go to kind of explore their culture and not feel ashamed about Jewish identity and kind of this anti-Semitic nativist moment. And he founds the Menorah Journal as a kind of an intellectual venue for this exploration of Jewish culture. And I think the Menorah Journal wouldn't have been that significant to this group of intellectuals, except that Elliot Cohen becomes the managing editor in the late 1920s through the early 1930s. And Elliot Cohen is the first to kind of bring together some of these writers, including someone like Lionel Trilling, who contributes to the Menorah Journal before he enrolls for his doctorate in English at Columbia University. Elliot Cohen is really important in kind of shaping this combative, polemical style in print. And Elliot Cohen goes on to be the first editor of Commentary magazine, which is founded in the post-war years in 1945 by the American Jewish Committee, though it has editorial freedom. And he leads Commentary magazine until he commits suicide in 1959. And then after a protracted battle, Norman Podhoretz becomes the new young editor of that magazine. But other journals are founded, too, in the post-war period. Dissent is founded by Irving Howe and Louis Kozer in 1954, partly because they feel like journals like Partisan Review and Commentary are abdicating to the Cold War line of the period and not being critical enough of McCarthyism, of Cold War liberalism. So that's founded in 1954. And then the New York Review of Books follows in 1963. It's founded during the New York City newspaper strike by Barbara Epstein, Robert Silvers, and Jason Epstein. And it becomes a really important journal. And then there's other ones throughout the period that emerge and fold. There's Politics, which is founded by Dwight MacDonald in 1944 and exists, I think, until 1949. There's Encounter, which is founded by the Congress for Cultural Freedom, and it's edited over in London, but Irving Kristol is editing it.
With a little help from the CIA.
A lot of help from the CIA, right? Thing that is discovered and becomes a scandal in the, you know, in the late 1960s. Irving Howe has this famous line where he says, you know, when intellectuals can think of nothing else, they start a magazine. And so getting back to your initial question, what are they doing? Well, initially they're writing and they're creating this kind of culture of small magazines that become really influential in the development of American intellectual life in the post-war years. But in the post-war years, as anti-Semitism is sort of discredited to some extent by the revelations of the Holocaust and what scientific racism can lead to, quotas disappear in the post-war years. Anti-discrimination measures are passed. And many of these intellectuals increasingly enter the academy, too, and they become professors at various institutions in the 1950s and certainly by the 1960s.
I'm speaking with Ronnie Grinberg, author of Write Like a Man, Jewish Masculinity and the New York Intellectuals, published by Princeton University Press. Partisan Review, of course, is very central to this whole story. And in the years before World War II, it was pretty left, pretty heavily Trotskyist influence, anti-Stalinist, but still Marxist. Then after the war, they had quite the turn and embraced the American way. So what happened?
For a lot of them, they concluded after World War II that America wasn't such a bad country after all. You know, some of these intellectuals opposed America's entry into World War II because that was the Trotskyist line, that America was just kind of another imperialist capitalist country. And I think after sort of witnessing the horrors of what was the Holocaust and coming to terms with that, and then also seeing the Soviet Union becoming an even more bigger threat in the post-war years when the United States and the Soviet Union become the two major superpowers, they conclude that America is worth defending. It's not such a bad place after all. And you know, famously, Partisan Review publishes a symposium in 1952 called Our Country, Our Culture. And just the very title sort of suggests this sense that these intellectuals who sort of saw themselves as outsiders in the pre-war period now very much see themselves as insiders in American life, and they embrace American notions of democracy and capitalism as being much better than the alternative, which is Soviet communism and totalitarianism. They're equating them.
Their anxieties about masculinity had something to do with this. The classic phrase, soft on communism, has captures that. But also, you know, the McCarthy era was as much homophobic as it was pursuing Reds. What did their ideas of masculinity, how did that affect this turn?
Yeah, I mean, I argue in the book, this was one of the hardest parts of the book to write because there's sort of no smoking gun. The sense that Jews have long been seen as not properly masculine. Jews have also long been identified with leftist politics, certainly the labor movement, socialism, and they seem to be disproportionately represented in the Communist Party. And so there's these fears in the post-war period. I should say also, like, you know, anti-Semitic discourses had also long tied Jews and homosexuals as kind of like sexual inverts. Jews having been circumcised, and so not quite properly manly in that way as well. And so I think in the post-war period, all those discourses are sort of intersecting. On the one hand, the post-war period, the 15 years after World War II, is sometimes cast as a golden era for American Jews, this period where they come into mainstream acceptance. But I think if you look at this like late 1940s and early 1950s period when McCarthyism is dominating American political life, there's a lot of anxiety in the American Jewish community. And so there's this desire to prove that American Jews are anti-communist, that they're properly American, both politically, but also in terms of gender. And all that's getting kind of played out in this moment. The New York intellectuals struggled with this moment and fiercely debated it. Irving Kristol famously defended McCarthy in some way because he said the American people at least know that he's anti-communist and they can't say anything about liberals who have been soft on communism. And yeah, this language of soft and hard is definitely gendered. I'm not the first scholar to talk about that. There's much better books that really interrogate that language. But this idea that being soft on communism means that you're not tough enough, masculine enough to take on the threats of the new world order that emerges after World War II.
Despite your title, you do write quite a bit about the women in this group. They were often seen as second class, not quite as serious, both by the members of this group, but also outsiders as well. Quite a few of them were very anti-feminist when feminism arrived in the scene in the 70s. What was their animus with feminism?
Well, I talk about how there were a lot of women writers who circled this group as wives and as lovers and as intellectuals themselves, and only a few are taken seriously and sort of become known as bona fide intellectuals, right? There's only a handful of them, some six or seven. They include Hannah Arendt, Mary McCarthy, Elizabeth Hardwick. Mary McCarthy and Elizabeth Hardwick are not Jewish. But then also Susan Sontag, Midge Dechter, Gertrude Himmelfarb. Diana Trilling was the other one, which is an important one not to forget. But then there's other women writers like Pearl Kazin Bell, who's married to Daniel Bell and the sister of Alfred Kazin, who's a writer too, and she's not quite seen as part of this group. She's not included as part of this group. So I sort of interrogate and want and think about, you know, who counts and who doesn't. And the argument I make in the book is that the women who counted ultimately embraced this combative masculine style of argumentation.
Write like a man, yes.
They wrote like a man. And I want to emphasize, because some critiques of my book have sort of thought that I'm essentializing writing. That's not what I'm doing. I'm saying, though, that these women kind of performed a type of masculinity they had to for these intellectuals, these men, to take them seriously. And it's not because there's a woman's way to write or a male way to write, but there was a certain type of argumentation that you did on print that was seen as writing like a man. Part of the reason why they rejected feminism was they had made it, and so they didn't need feminism. But I think there was also the sense that feminists wrote like women. They wrote about distinctly unserious issues in distinctly unserious ways. They dismissed it as kind of frivolous.
There are a couple of characters, a married couple, Midge Dechter and Norman Putteritz, who were really, you know, among the founders of neoconservatism. Dechter herself is extremely anti-feminist and really homophobic about it, as was Putteritz. How do you account for that neoconservative turn? What got to them?
I sort of show in my chapters on neoconservatism that there were gender anxieties long present among the New York intellectuals, and certainly among Podhoretz and Midge Dechter. Norman Podhoretz, I think there's a desire to prove his masculinity that he feels, or Jewish masculinity that he feels, under siege starting in the early 1960s. And so when he writes My Negro Problem and Ours, which is one of his most famous essays in 1963, it's a response, I should say, to James Baldwin's book, The Fire Next Time. He talks about how when he grew up in Brownsville, Brooklyn, he was picked on by African Americans because he was scholarly and studious and a good student, and he was called a sissy, which he calls the most dreaded epithet in American boyhood. And what's interesting about Podhoretz is he's, you know, in his own reflections of his intellectual and political journey, he claims that in the early 1960s, when he takes over as editor of Commentary, which is in 1960, and when he's writing My Negro Problem and Ours, these are years where he's embracing the new left and actually shifting the magazine leftwards away from its Cold War, stodgy establishment liberalism during the Elliot Cohen years and embracing the radicalism of the new left. But I think if you look carefully at his writings, that's not entirely what's going on. There's these real gender anxieties that are shaping his politics. And particularly when you look at Midge Dechter, she begins writing in the late 1950s and the early 1960s, and she's an anti-feminist before feminism even emerges. She doesn't see sex discrimination as a real issue because in her view, and again, these are things that she's saying in 1960, so before Betty Friedan publishes The Feminine Mystique, in her view, men and women are fundamentally different. She essentializes gender roles, this idea that women are mothers and that they don't have to support themselves. And so that if there's discrimination in a profession, it makes sense because most women are going to quit their jobs anyways to get married and have children. Discrimination doesn't really exist because men and women have different roles to play in society. And so these are arguments she's making beginning in the early 1960s. She doesn't see gender as a social construction, but rather from a revisionist Freudian lens in the 1950s, she's seeing sort of gender distinctions or sex distinctions as innate.
Phyllis Schlafly's name comes up in the book, and both she and Dechter were professedly anti-feminist, but lived essentially feminist lives. The way they lived their lives was very at odds with what they professed.
100%. I mean, it's completely at odds. They're both professional women who pursue careers, who kind of transcend this idea that women are solely mothers and wives, yet they are completely blind to their own privilege that allowed them to be able to do that. You know, having husbands who supported them, it blinds them to the type of challenges that women face in the workforce. It's interesting. I found this quote that Midge Dector gives in the late 1970s that's not particularly favorable towards Phyllis Schlafly, even though they're espousing similar ideas. She says something to the extent of, you know, Phyllis Schlafly and Bella Abzug deserve one another. And when I asked Midge Dector, I got the opportunity to interview her in 2011 or 2012 about that quote. She claimed that she didn't remember, but then she sort of mentioned that, you know, her and Phyllis Schlafly just came out of very different milieus, and she wasn't really a movement person, and that she later felt the need to apologize to Schlafly. And so there was this sort of embrace of what Schlafly was doing. And one of the arguments that I make in the book is that Midge Dector's anti-feminism and anti-gay writings that predate the supposed neocon turn in the late 1960s, right, that you can see already in the late 50s and the early 1960s, merges with the anti-feminist campaign that Phyllis Schlafly leads beginning in the 1970s that becomes central to the new right. And so Midge Dector plays this really important role in fusing the neocons into the larger conservative movement. And there's conservatives who are anti-Semitic, who sort of look at these neocons and see a lot of former liberal and even Trotskyist Jews who are now trying to be conservative, and so, or who are now proclaiming that they're conservative. And, you know, there's these fierce pitched battles between the groups in the late 1980s and the early 1990s. But I think Midge Dector is this really critical figure in kind of unifying the conservative movement because her writings were so anti-feminist, homophobic from the very beginning.
Finally, what should we take from this school? They're getting to be kind of old now. Most of them are dead. What is their lasting influence, good or bad?
That's a good question. I mean, I'm always struck with how this group seems to have this mystique that still resonates in New York and American literary circles. I mean, you might know better than I do coming from the world of journalism and print magazine. But I think that a younger generation of writers and critics kind of look to these intellectuals kind of as their forefathers. This pugnacious and combative style of argumentation shaped American letters in the second half of the 20th century through the early 21st century. I think there's a nostalgia for this group of intellectuals precisely because it was so much more grounded in deep intellectual thought as opposed to just barbs the way we see them on Twitter.
That was Ronnie Grinberg, author of Write Like a Man, published last year by Princeton University Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, an old pop evocation of a world that was very different from that of the New York intellectuals. Tim Curry doing I Do the Rock. Till next week, bye.
Track publicity, I do the rock myself. I do the rock. Carter, Begin, and Sadat, Redner, Deng, and Castro. Every day negotiate, gas close that to disaster. Idi Amin, and the Shah, and Al Fatah is quite bizarre. I could never get the hang.